Colton?
Just flip it up.
Oh, yeah, you can flip it up. No, no. Just blow it
up. If you want to turn this one on, so you can sit over here.
Oh, okay. That's fine. That works.
Okay, let me know when I should start. That was good.
It's recorded yet.
Okay, excellent. So, first of all, it's a tremendous honor to be here and to be in the show of Rabbi Eisenstein, who's one of the superstars in the Yeshiva at Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan world, as well as Tim Aryeh, and contributed so much and continues to do so for Klal Yisrael. Of course, my publisher, David Feinberg, recently came out with a sefer called the Kanfei Yona several months ago, and I have to really thank David Feinberg for the hours and hours of work that he put into it, the wee hours of the morning, at least the wee hours of the morning for me, but often the wee hours of the morning for him as well. And of course I appreciate the fine words from Aaron as well, and appreciate the attendance of all of you. So the Yerushalmi says that in any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's as if we have destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's a pretty strong statement. So what does that mean? It's as if we've destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. We're not the Romans, we're not the Babylonians. What does that mean? The generation has destroyed the Beis HaMikdash? It means that there were various reasons why the Beis HaMikdash, the Bat HaMikdash, were destroyed. And every single generation that passes, where we do not remedy all of the mistakes that we make, and we do not correct all of the sins that we perform, so then that is what is keeping the geula from happening, and therefore it's considered like our actions, Rahman al-Islam, are a hemshake, they're a continuation of this notion of korban, of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So we know that the core reason why the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, which is the one that the destruction that was still reeling from up until this very day, was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. Gemara in Gittin talks about that there was tremendous hatred, unnecessary hatred, between fellow Jews, and therefore we have to assume that this is an area that we need to work upon in order to earn the right to redemption, to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, I want to speak a little bit about Sinas Chinam. I want to speak a little bit about Machlokas in this context. And it is not only appropriate to speak about it in terms of memorializing the reason the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and what we need to do in order to bring about its rebuilding, but also because, paradoxically, perhaps, this period of time is considered, on some level, the most suitable for us to be able to address our past wrongs. The Pasuk in Eicha says, "Kol gotfeah hisiguah bein ha-mitzarim." All of those who pursued us and chased us were unfortunately able to capture us. Bein HaMitzarim. What does Bein HaMitzarim mean? So Rashi, there in his parish to Megillah Seicha, quotes the Medrash Agada. Bein HaMitzarim means between these two bookmarks, Bein Yud Zayin Tammuz to Tisha B'Av, between the tragedy that befell us on Yud Zayin Tammuz, that was the day of the Shviras Haluchos and other calamities, and Tisha B'Av, which of course was the time of the destruction of both Bat and Mikdashos, but the sin that brought about Tisha B'Av was the Chet HaMeraglim. So really this is the period of time which reminds us of the terrible sins that were committed when we left Mitzrayim. Number one, the Chet HaEgel, and number two, the Chet HaMeraglim. So that's how we understand Bein HaMitzarim. The Ora, the Sefer, Or Gedaliah, by Rav Gedaliah Shor, he quotes from the Chassidish Sfarim that explain that if we look at the wording carefully, we can split it up and get another message from this pasuk of Rodfeah, Nisigua Bein HaMitzarim. The word Rodfeah can be split up into two words, Korodeif Ka. Korodeif Ka. Anybody who seeks to pursue HaKadosh Baruch Hu, somebody who wants to really reestablish the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to reestablish that connection between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu to get again into the good favor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is the ideal time to be able to accomplish that. This is Bein HaMitzarim. It's very interesting because Rashi goes on to say that the Bein HaMitzarim, even the wording Bein HaMitzarim, we find in Megillas Eicha, has two separate connotations. One is that it's a makom that's sar v'gavoa, that it's a that the Bein HaMitzarim is like a place which is narrow straits, and there's no place to run, and that this was a period of time where we couldn't run away from our enemies on some level. Or, says Rashi, Bein HaMitzarim is also a lashon of gibulos. It's also a lashon of boundaries. We're about to read the Shabbos Parshas Maaseh. In America, they're also going to be Parshas Maaseh. They're also going to throw in Parshas Matos, which we read here last Shabbos, but everyone's going to catch up with each other. Another good siman, I hope, of Klal Yisrael coming together. Parshas Maaseh, there's a constant reference to Meitzar, to a boundary, to a border, that the land of Israel is described as a place of Mitzarim. It's a place of lots and lots of boundaries and borders, a lot of gulot, a lot of different areas that are designated for Klal Yisrael to live in within Eretz Yisrael. So we see that there's a dichotomy here, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu presents us with a tragic and sad period of time, that right now we observe through mourning. It's a makom tsar v'gavoa, and in makom lanus, and it's something which reminds us of our troubles and our misfortunes. But we have the ability to turn this around, to transform it, to completely alter the meaning of Bein HaMitzarim, to be about re-establishing our homeland, bringing back all of Klal Yisrael from all Tekutzo to Aretz, from all places in the world, and rebuilding Yerushalayim, Bibinyana, and the Beis HaMikdash, and having a complete Geula, so that the Bein HaMitzarim will mean that we are completely re-established in our land, and we'll have a happy connotation, and the days will be turned into happy days. And that's why some of the Svarim, the Sifrei Parshanut, talk about how this is why it's not a coincidence that every single year during the Bein HaMitzarim period we read Parshas Maaseh. It's not that it just happens to fall out during Bein HaMitzarim. It's that it's supposed to give us the encouragement that, oh, we could be really, if we do the right thing and we behave ourselves, we could be talking about a very different type of Mitzvah. We could just be talking about reestablishing the boundaries of the land, putting every single Shevet in the proper place, and so forth. And therefore, it's a reminder to us that this is really all in our hands. I saw a beautiful word in the Sefer of my Chavir, by Baruch Simon in the Imre Baruch, where he quotes the common question that's asked, just that people don't necessarily, sometimes when there's a really good question, people remember the question, but they're not necessarily so sure of the answer, so it's good about his sefers that he like gives you answers to. So the common question that's asked is, we know that it was recorded, Parshas Maaseh, that in the middle of the description of the Masos, that Aaron HaKohen died. Aaron HaKohen died, that he died on the first day of Chodesh Av. And this is the only Yahrzeit that is recorded in the entirety of the Torah. The Torah talks about various people dying. Doesn't tell you the date, the specific date that people died, with the exception of Aaron HaKohen. So the famous question is, why is this the only Yahrzeit which is mentioned in the Torah? And he quotes from, appropriately named, the Sefer Beis Aaron, that explains that the reason is because what was Aaron all about? Aaron was all about Oyev Shalom, Odeyev Shalom, Oyev Sabrius, Mekaben, the Torah. He was all about pursuing peace. The two people, the Yavasra, late Rabbi Nassan, talks about two people would have a dispute. So Aaron HaKohen would go to each one of them separately, and he would say, oh, the other one really wants to make up with you. And then that would cause them to want to have a rapprochement with each other, and they would make up with each other. One question is, isn't that Gnevus Das? He was telling each person, oh, the other one really wants to make up with you. The answer is, of course it's not Gnevus Das, because deep down, every single Yid wants to get along with every other Yid. Of course they wanted to make up with each other, just that they might not necessarily have recognized that. because they weren't in touch with the innermost recesses of their Yetzer HaTov. And Aaron HaKohen was able to bring that out. That's why when he died, it was very close to Kobe. He saw everybody cried and mourned when he died, because he brought shalom between warring factions, warring people, even between warring husbands and wives. There were much fewer gittin during the days of Aaron HaKohen. So therefore, the Yahrzeit of Aaron HaKohen is specifically recorded, because when did he die? He died on Rosh Chodesh Av. Rosh Chodesh Av, which epitomizes this time of division and pirut within Klal Yisrael, and it led to all of these terrible tragedies. So the Torah is telling us, if you want to undo the tragedies, if you want to move away from that paradigm, so remember Aaron HaKohen. Please follow the example of Aaron HaKohen. Unfortunately, Aaron HaKohen died. Just because he died doesn't mean that his legacy can't continue. And therefore, we have to do our best to emulate the legacy of Aaron HaKohen by bringing about a shalom between individuals and within our communities. And what is instructive in this regard, when we think about the Ben Adam L'Chaveru aspect of what we're supposed to transform during this period of time, Rav David said that he would appreciate if I could speak about Machlokes. So we'll start with the original Machlokes, which, according to the Gemara, brought about the Chorban, brought about the Chorban of Yerushalayim. And that was, of course, the case that's recorded in the Gemara in Gittin, where there was a certain individual. He had somebody who was his friend and somebody who was his enemy. The friend was Kamsa, the enemy was Bar Kamsa. He made a party, and the Shliach, who sent out the invitations, was supposed to invite Kamsa, his good friend, but instead he invited Bar Kamsa. Bar Kamsa shows up to the party. And this guy gets really angry, and he tells Bar Kamsa, you gotta get out of here, and he embarrasses him in front of everybody. And Bar Kamsa tries his best to avoid the embarrassment and humiliation, says, I'll pay for my meal. I'll pay for the meal of half of the people here. I'll pay for the meal of everybody who's here. And the fellow is unrelenting, and he disgraces Bar Kamsa by throwing him out. And Bar Kamsa gets so angry that he decides he's going to get all the Jews into trouble. And he goes to the emperor, and he has him send a korban to be offered. And he puts a moon, he puts a blemish in the korban. And the Jews had a dilemma, because they couldn't offer this korban that had a blemish, a very small blemish. There wouldn't be a blemish for non-Jews if they were offering the korban on a bama, but it is a blemish if it's going to be offered in the Beis HaMikdash, either on the lips or in the eyes, a very small little blemish. And they asked for Zechariah ben Achulas, who was the reigning gadol, as to what they should do. And they said, maybe we should offer it anyway, so as not to get into trouble. And Rosh Chaim and Kula said, well, that would be against the din, and we can't falsify the Torah. The Torah says that you can't offer such a korban. So they said, to Rosh Chaim and Kula, okay, so let's kill Bar Kamsa, another convenient solution, so that he's not going to tell the emperor that we didn't offer the korban. He said, well, then people will say that if you put a moon, you put a blemish in a korban, then the penalty is the death, and that's also against the truth of the Torah, and therefore he would not allow them to resort to either of these solutions. And the emperor got very angry, and that's what caused the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed. So Rabbi Yochanan got up and he said that Anmisanuso shel Rabbi Zechariah ben Achulas, his tremendous Anmisanuso. What does that mean? His humility, his forbearance, that he was prepared not to take any radical steps. It caused the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed, our sanctuary to be destroyed. It caused us to go into Golos. So, what do we learn in terms of how to repair our Ben Adam L'Chaveru from this this incident? So, I'd like to suggest a couple of things relating to two questions that really stand out from this incident. There are really two questions that have been posed in the past. Again, questions that don't have easy answers, but I'm going to suggest a couple of answers. So the question is, the Gemara says it's because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa that Yerushalayim was destroyed. So we understand why Bar Kamsa had something to do with it, but what did Kamsa have to do with it? Kamsa just didn't get his invitation in the mail. So why is Kamsa being blamed for all of this? And on some level, if we go back to the paradigm of Aharon HaKohen, we can understand this a little bit better. Bar Kamsa got the invitation, probably thought, look, I'm this guy's enemy, but if we really were in an atmosphere of Avas Chinam, there was tremendous potential over here, so he may have thought to himself, look, this is a serendipitous way to be able to repair the breach and to be able to repair this relationship with this individual. But that wasn't the way the individual who sent the invitation looked at it, because it wasn't really a priority to get along with everybody. It was more a priority to have your chevra and to be very close with your chevra and to be really, really nice and to be really generous with respect to your own group. But part of what defined the viability of a group was the ability to denigrate other groups. Does this sound familiar? We don't even realize sometimes when we do this within the film community of today, but if we listen to conversations around the Shabbos table, we listen to the way in which we speak about people who aren't entirely like us, sometimes we might recognize or appreciate that we're not completely faultless when it comes to this phenomenon of advancing our own stature by denigrating other Jews. The Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Berlin, in his Shailos HaTshuvos Meishiv Dover, I think maybe Simon Mem Hei, talks about this as well, and speaks to the phenomenon of different groups of genuinely from people who just have different views, perhaps different paths of serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Each one refers to the others as apikorsim. Oh, you're a Zionist, you're an apikors. You're not a Zionist, you're an apikors. Whatever it is you might be. You value secular studies, you're an apikors. You take welfare money because you're sitting in Kola, you're an apikors. And people just very carelessly throw out these types of pejoratives and these types of labels. And we have to really take a step back and do our best to, you know, stop doing that, because in this context we can understand that this was indeed the sin of Kamsa. Kamsa knew all this time that he had received his stature based on a corresponding hatred towards this fellow Bar Kamsa. Some even say that Kamsa was the father and Bar Kamsa was the son. Very reasonable inference given their names. There was a close connection, but Kamsa didn't mind the fact that this other person, even if it was a close relative, was being denigrated, because it helped to advance and promote his own stature. And therefore, it was not a l'shma type of friendship, a l'shma type of bein odom l'chaveiro, even amongst those who were invited to the party, because it was a party that solidified bonds at the cost and the expense of denigrating others. And the other question that arises is, what do you want from poor Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulis? Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulis was doing his job as a rabbi. He had halakha questions that were presented to him, and he answered the halakha questions. We know that the Yam Shel Shlomo, the Maharshal, says we have various types of Yisurim that are Yerei Vayavu. You have to give up your life rather than violate them, like murder and idolatry and incest and so forth. But he says that really Zil Patora also falls into this category based on the Gemara in Bava Kamma, where he says that to falsify the Torah is something that can never be done at any cost, because our primary mission is to preserve the authenticity of the Torah and to transmit it from generation to generation. And therefore, even if it might lead to the cost of the lives of people dying, because we're truthful about what the Torah demands and what the Torah says, so that's a price that we would have to pay. So it seems that that's all that Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulis was doing. And furthermore, if we're really criticizing Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulis, why are we using the words anbesanuso? Anbesanuso is like a pretty good thing. Like, you're supposed to be an anav. You're supposed to, we speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the anbesanuso of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we generally use that word in a positive framework. So Rabbi J. David Bleich Shlita says that is indeed true, that the understanding of the Gemara as a criticism of Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulis is not actually the correct interpretation. The Gemara is saying that Rabbi Sakai ben Akkuz acted properly. Because he acted properly, so yes, it's true that as a side effect, Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, but there were incidents, there were circumstances that were set up that were independent of his ruling, and this was just an unfortunate byproduct of all the circumstances that came about because of the controversy, because of the machlokis between the host and Bar Kamsa. But it wasn't as if, strictly speaking, Rav Zechariah ben Akulis did anything wrong. I'd like to take that interpretation of Rabbi Blight, and I'd like to tweak it a little bit so that we can learn something from it in terms of our responsibilities. There's a line in the Gemara when it talks about the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa that says that the prominent rabbis of the time were also invited to this party. And they were sitting, I guess, at the rabbi's table, you know, as whatever, you know, it was. And they were witnessing this entire exchange, this shouting match between the host and the poor Bar Kamsa, who was just, you know, trying his best to spare himself from embarrassment. And it says the Gemara, they did not make a mechal. They did not rebuke the host for the way that he was speaking to Bar Kamsa. They did not intervene. They just sat and they did absolutely nothing. And the Gemara just goes on and finishes the story. But obviously, if that line is in the Gemara, it must be teaching us something of import in terms of what the chait was that led to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And even the Rabbanim were not speaking out regarding this terrible scandal of a breach in basic ben adam l'chaveiro relations that was being played out in public. They just kind of cowered at their table or sat and did nothing. In other words, they were also part of this clique, if you were. They were also part of this group that validated each other by only inviting each other and only being respectful of each other, but not being respectful of other people. So I think that maybe what the Gemara means when it says Anusanuso shall, and this is a statement made by Rabbi Yochanan, that the Anusanuso shall Rabbi Zechariah ben Akulos is what brought about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It means something akin to another Gemara in Maseches Yuma that speaks about how sometimes good traits can cause others who don't necessarily have those good traits to be exposed and to be held responsible. What am I referring to? It's Gemara Yuma that speaks about, you know, Hillel was mechayev es aniyim, and Rabbi Elazar ben Karsum was mechayev es ha'ashirim. And Hillel was very, very poor. And a person who was poor could have gotten away conceivably with saying that they didn't learn that much Torah because they had to eke out the livelihood, they had to go collect the money, they had tremendous trials and tribulations in their life. They could have made an excuse as to why they didn't learn Torah. So it says the Gemara, once Hillel came along, and Hillel was very, very poor, he would rest on top of the roof of the Beis Medrash and listen to the Shiurim, and even though he would sacrifice his well-being and he didn't have warm clothes to keep him comfortable, nonetheless, he did everything that he could, even in his poverty, to spend as much time as possible learning Torah. And therefore, that's a good thing. We're not angry at Hillel. We're not denigrating Hillel, because Hillel showed that it was possible. Therefore, he was mechayev all the other aniyim that they're obligated to learn Torah too. Similarly, the Gemara speaks about Rabbi Elazar ben Karsum. Rabbi Elazar ben Karsum was a gavra. He was a macher in the community. He was somebody who had lots of investments. He had books that were traveling all over the place with the various merchandise that he had to keep track of. And he could have made the excuse that he's so busy managing all of his business ventures, he doesn't have time to learn Torah. But it's not what he did. Rabbi Elazar ben Karsum set aside lots and lots of time to learn Torah, and still was able to manage his business ventures. So therefore says the Gemara, Rabbi Elazar ben Karsum was mechayev es ha'ashirim, that other rich people could no longer make the excuse, oh, I'm so rich and busy with my investments, and I'm donating so much money anyway to all the shuls and mishkafayim and wherever else, and therefore I'm not obligated to learn Torah. No, Once Rabbi Elazar ben Karsan came along, so he couldn't make that excuse. So I think maybe that's what the Gemara means with respect to Lam Sanuso, Shel Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos. Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos showed that it was possible for people in that generation to stand up for principle, despite the fact that it could come at a tremendous cost. It was in a Ben Adam Lamakom realm, where he said that we cannot compromise the laws of the Torah that says that you can't offer a korban that has a mum, even if it's only a small little slit on the lips or in the eyelid, or something that we're never allowed to do, and we can't kill somebody for placing a blemish in an animal, because that's not what the Torah says. And even though there might be terrible consequences from this, maybe there'll be a destruction based in English, maybe the enemy will attack us, it doesn't matter, we have to stand up for principle. So he showed that it was possible to stand up for principle. Once, Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos showed that it was possible to have that anvesanuso. It doesn't mean anvesanuso. It means that he was not influenced by his surroundings. He had the sufficient humility that he recognized that the one always has to do the will of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that was mechayev everybody else. Therefore, everybody else who sinned by not standing up for principle when there was a shaming on a Bein Adam L'Chavero level of a fellow Jew, and the host was screaming and throwing out Bar Kotze from the feast, and they just sat there and did nothing, so they can no longer argue, well, it'd be very difficult, it would stare the whole simcha, it would create even greater tensions if we're going to get up and we're going to insult our host. So we see from Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos that at least on a Bein Adam L'Makom level, he was willing to stand up for the principles of the Torah, and therefore they were all held accountable for not standing up for the principles of Bein Adam L'Chavero, even if it was inconvenient and even if it was uncomfortable at the time. But there's another footnote to the story, and that is that if you look in the Medrash Eicha gives you the identity of one of the rabbis who was sitting there at the Suda and didn't get up to make a macha, and didn't say anything to protest the terrible treatment that Bar Kamsa was receiving from the host. And that individual was none other than Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos. So Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulos himself was mechayev himself, according to this interpretation, that he demonstrated that he was able to stand up for the principles of Bein Adam L'Makom, even if it could potentially come at great cost. But once he demonstrated he had that capability, so then there was a tremendous kasha on him, there was a tremendous taina that could be brought against him. Why didn't he stand up on principle when it came to a violation of Bein Adam L'Chavero? So this is what we also have to think about during this period of time. Sometimes we're very scrupulous and very, very meticulous about our Bein Adam L'Makom, but much less so with respect to the Bein Adam L'Chavero. This is what is preventing the Beis HaMikdash from being rebuilt. This is what we really have to work on during this period of time. I'll tell you what I consider to be the most difficult halacha of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, there are all kinds of things that you can't do because it is a replica of the period of Avelus. So you're not supposed to wash on Tisha B'Av, you're not supposed to wear shoes on Tisha B'Av, you're not supposed to do all kinds of different things on Tisha B'Av that are akin to what it is that an Avel would not be allowed to do either, in addition to obviously not eating or drinking on Tisha B'Av, no Tashvi Shemitah on Tisha B'Av, etc. There's one halacha which we apply in Tisha B'Av, which is also applied to Avelim, that sometimes is very, very difficult. And that's the Isser Sheila Shalom. The Isser Sheila Shalom on Tisha B'Av. You ever go to a shul on Tisha B'Av, it's not your regular shul, you're traveling or something, you're walking through, somebody sees you, they're all excited to see you Tisha B'Av morning. They come over and say, hey, how are you doing? It's wonderful to see you. And you're not allowed to respond in a jovial or even in a pleasant fashion. You have to respond like the COVID roast. Oh, no, it's Tisha B'Av. I don't even want to say anything. And it seems sort of jarring that we would insult people on this very day, which commemorates the sin of Sinas Chinam that brought about the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Couldn't we make an exception, at least, with respect to She'elas Shalom, to it being pleasant to people and greet people on Tisha B'Av? Why is it that that's something that we're not allowed to do? So I think that the answer is that on Tisha B'Av, we're supposed to be brought to an appreciation of the way things are supposed to be. The way things are supposed to be is that this is supposed to be a day of happiness. Even from the original Chayin Meraglim, it took place on Tisha B'Av, this was a day in which everybody was supposed to say, the Meraglim was supposed to say, this land is Tovah Haaretz Me'od Me'od, not only Yeshua and Kalik, but everybody should have said Tovah Haaretz Me'od Me'od. All of the Klal Yisrael should have said, we're listening to Yeshua and Kalik, and we're going to go up to the land, and we're going to conquer the land. But they didn't have that sense of positivity, and therefore, instead of it being a day of Simcha L'Doros, it became a day of Bechiya L'Doros. So too, even now, Tisha B'Av is a day in which we have the potential to build the third Beis HaMikdash, but right now, we have not succeeded, and therefore, we stay away from all of the things that we view as optimal. To be able to wash yourself with a hot shower, that's optimal. To be able to eat a nice meal, so that's something which is optimal. To be able to wear nice, comfortable shoes, so that's something which is optimal. To be able to sleep in the same bed as your spouse, these are all things which are optimal. So we remind ourselves on Tisha B'Av that today we're not allowed to engage in Sheila Shalom. So what's the message that Halacha sends to us? That normally we're supposed to want to engage in Sheila Shalom. That normally this is something that we live for. Something that gives us happiness, that gives us fulfillment in life. And we feel so bad that we're not able to engage in those greetings, that we're not able to engage in pleasantries. It reminds us that the rest of the time, not only on Shabbos with a perfunctory good Shabbos, but the rest of the week and the rest of the time as well, we're supposed to stop people and ask, how are you, how are you doing? And not just a perfunctory, how are you doing? But to really care about how people are and how they're doing and to seek to help them and to seek to be generous and kind to people in their various predicaments. So this, I think, is what we're supposed to think about when we learn the sugya of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that number one, whatever kindness we bestow upon each other should not be just for the purpose of social standing, that, oh, I get along well with this group, so I'll get a good shit up from this group, but that we're supposed to be non-discriminating in terms of getting along with all of Klal Yisrael. And secondly, that we have to stand up in principle as well when it comes to Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. And it's something that we should yearn for. We should yearn to have good, close relationships with every single individual. There's another kasha that gets asked. It's a famous kasha, the Sfasemis, the Sam Sofer. They all ask this question. Maybe here the answer is a little bit more well-known, but I'll mention it anyway. Which is that the Gemara in Titus and Daf Lamed Amud Beis speaks about the pasuk in Yeshayahu, Simchas Yishalayim Megilu Bakol Aver Sisu Itam Asos Kol Misavlu Malah, and the Gemara says Kol Misavlu Yishalayim Zochav Ruvis in Pasuk. If you mourn upon Yishalayim, it's okay. Then if you will, you merit to see the happiness of Yishalayim. If you don't have if you don't observe a Beilus on Yerushalayim, you're not going to see the happiness of Yerushalayim at the end. So the question, the kasha that's asked is, well, we're praying, well, we're Mis'avil on Yerushalayim, we're praying for the restoration of Jewish sovereignty completely, we shouldn't have enemies to worry about, we're praying for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt, this is what we're praying about. That's something in the future. It hasn't happened yet. We're mourning now because it hasn't happened yet. So shouldn't the Maimer in the Gemara, instead of saying Zokhe V'roe B'Simchasa, shouldn't it say Yiske V'yire B'Simchasa, that you will merit, you will be able to see the happiness, the joy of Yerushalayim. So why is it in the present tense? So the Sfasemis and others as well give the explanation that it's all about a mindset. That the whole purpose of the mourning period during the 3 weeks, during the Tisha B'Av season, is to remind us about what's really, really important. To remind us that Abbas Binam is very, very important. Reconnecting to a Kodesh Baruch Hu is very, very important. That even though it's the summer season, this is much more important to us than going to movies and listening to music and taking haircuts and all of the other things that during this period of time, that true happiness for us is the happiness of having a strong relationship in other makam, and having a strong relationship in other makabeo. Therefore, if you mourn properly during this period of time, so then that changes your perspective and you come to the realization that what's really important in life is not going to a good restaurant and watching a good movie or going to a concert, but what's really, really important in life is reestablishing our bonds min adam l'chaveru, reestablishing our bonds min adam l'makom. Once we come to that realization, then already it's El Chavirah is impossible. Then we're in a much higher place than we were before, and therefore the quality of our lives becomes greatly improved and enhanced. Once the quality of our lives in that respect becomes greatly improved and enhanced, so then, of course, it brings us much closer to the Geula, but we've already made a significant stride forward. Because we've already made that significant stride forward, therefore already it's El Chavirah is impossible. So I'd just like to conclude the remaining time, I guess we have maybe 10, 15 minutes or so, with a further discussion regarding ways to avoid this type of sinas inam, ways to avoid machlokes. There is a medrash. The medrash appears, not surprisingly, in Parshas Koach. Parshas Koach is all about machlokes. And the medrash says that there are Abba and Nikroim Meshoyim, that there are four different types of individuals who are called wicked. Who are the four types of individuals who are called wicked? Haposhe yado l'chaveru l'hakoso, somebody who raises up his hand against his fellow to hit him, apopi shaloiko, even though he does not end up whacking him, he's still called a rasha, as Moshe Rabbeinu said, rasha lama takeriyeho. Moshe Rabbeinu said, we saw two Jews fighting with each other, so he said to the one who lifted up his hand to harm the other, he called him a rasha. Second category is ve'alovet ve'enu mishalim, somebody who borrows money, doesn't repay the money. As it says in Tehillim, lo ve'rasha v'lo yishalem, that if you're a borrower, you're a rasha if you don't pay up. And then third category, somebody who is brazen and does not have any kind of embarrassment or deference towards those who are greater than him. As it says in the Pasuk of Mishlei, that if you are brazen in that fashion, then you're considered to be an Ish Rasha. And finally, the fourth category would be sort of the obvious one based on what we've been discussing up until now, which is Umishu Bamachloke, somebody who's constantly trying to stir up controversy within the community and the like. Shenemar, as it says, with respect to Adas Koach, Sunamiya Ahalei Hanashim HaRishuim HaEle, that they were all considered to be Rishayim because the Baalei Machlokes. So the question is, what do you mean that there are four who are called Rishayim? Are these the only categories of Rishayim that you find in all of Tanakh? What about somebody who's Chayiv Malkus? Somebody who's Chayiv Malkus, we say, Vahaya Ibn Akos HaRasha. What about somebody who's Chayiv Misa? Somebody who's Chayiv Misa, there's a pasuk that says, Asher Hu Rasha Lamus, also considered Rishayim. So why is it that we specifically single out these four categories? And I think the answer is, well, where does this Medrash appear? This Medrash appears in Parshas Koach. What is climax of the Medrash? The climax of the Medrash is Mishu Baal Machlokes, the last category. That's the culmination of the Medrash. So I would submit, what the Medrash is really telling us is that this type of rishus, this type of wickedness of being a Baal Machlokes, is not only somebody who's constantly looking to stir up controversy, but it's also somebody who fits one of these three other categories as well. We'll go through them. Person lifts up his arm to hit somebody. That doesn't only have to be a case of lifting up your arm to hit somebody. That could be simply that you're uncompromising, you have a dispute. It could be a monetary dispute that you have with somebody. It could be some type of a philosophical dispute that you have regarding the minhagim that should be established in a shul or something of that variety. And instead of trying to work things out in an amicable and peaceful fashion, you have people who take extremely strong and zealous positions to the effect that they only are interested in attacking the other side rather than working together with the other side. And this is reflected by Gemara and Bava Metzia, on Daf Amud Beis. The Gemara says, Lochav Yerushalayim ala al shedonu badin Torah. Gives another reason why Yerushalayim was destroyed. Yerushalayim was destroyed because of the fact that they followed din Torah. See, you scratch your head. Say, wait a second, that's like you're supposed to be to start cases according to din Torah. So the Gemara asks, Latina the Megistu Ludaino is supposed to decide cases according to witchcraft. Well, obviously, it's supposed to follow din Torah. So the Gemara answers very instructively. It means that everybody said, Yikava din Sahar. Everybody said, I want to get everything that's coming to me according to a strict letter of the law, and I'm not prepared to compromise one iota. And the Gemara says, you're not prepared to compromise one iota when you have a dispute with somebody else. That's not what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants. It's not looking for you to follow din Torah at the expense of the Bein Adam L'Chaveru. You have to work out a compromise and you have to try to amicably settle your differences. That's why when we have divorce cases, for example, in front of the Beis Din, our first line of attack is not to have a full-fledged litigation between the parties, but to try to work out a mediation. When we sit down, and there could be an amicable resolution regarding all of the different issues of the money and the children and so forth, it's always much better to do things amicably, and if you don't, and you take this winner takes all type of attitude, so that is something that is an indication of really being a Baal Machlokas, even though you may not think that you're being a Baal Machlokas. You have to be flexible. Second category is Lovavayim Mishal. What does it mean? You borrow and you don't pay up. So why is this specifically singled out? So I think it's based on the Gemara and Bava Metzia. Gemara and Bava Metzia says that if you have money and you loan them without having witnesses who are able to testify about the transaction, you violate the Nevi Elositin Mishal. Why is that? Because the person who borrowed the money might forget to pay it back, and they may forget that they ever borrowed the money, and if you don't have a record and you don't have witnesses who are able to testify, so then it will come about to Machlokas because the borrower will not have a reminder to refresh his or her recollection that they borrowed the money, and therefore it's going to lead to Machlokas. Well, if everything was recorded very carefully from the inception, so then you wouldn't have this problem. And similarly, we have the story about Ravashi and Ravina, that Ravashi was told, we think that Ravina follows Kula Toa Kula. Ravashi, I mean, we always put Ravashi and Ravina together, but you know they had their own interactions. So Ravashi said, let me test Ravina. So he said to Ravina, on an Arab Shabbos, I have a small plot of land that I want to buy, loan me some money. So Ravina said, I'm not going to loan you any money unless there are witnesses that are going to be present to be able to testify to the transaction. So Ravashi said, you don't trust me? So he said, no, because you're so involved in your learning that you may forget the details of the transaction. So therefore, what Loga Vena Mishan really connotes are people who enter into undertakings without thinking out in the long term what pieces of evidence and of protection need to be in place so there won't be any misunderstandings down the road. That's why we always say to people, you enter into a transaction, don't do it orally. Put everything in writing, have every single contingency placed in writing. Lawyers are trained to be careful about this. You're trying to contemplate all of the eventualities so that it won't lead to a misunderstanding down the road, because when you have a misunderstanding, then that leads to terrible machlokes. This is why I think that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, in Perek Beis, says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked all of his Tamidim, what is the best way? Is the derech hasher shibak ba'adam? What's the best way for a person to behave? And then he asked them, Ezu derech rashi suafek ben ha'adam? What's the worst way that a person can behave? And almost everybody that he asked five times, then they gave two different sides of the same coin. They said, a good thing is chavito, bad thing is chavira. Good thing shalchein to, bad thing shalchein ra. Good thing ayin to, bad thing ayin ra. It comes along Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Shimon seems to say two things that don't match up with each other. He says, a good thing is haroes and olad, bad thing is lo ve'vienu mishalim. So why did he depart from all of his chavirim and say two things that didn't match up with each other? So the answer is they do match up with each other. That is the problem of lo ve'vienu mishalim that brings about machlokes, because he's dealing with somebody who's not roes and nola, who borrowed in a way that the transaction was not duly recorded, in which all the eventualities were not carefully planned out to make sure that there wouldn't be a controversy at the end of the road, and therefore that is why it is exactly the opposite counterpart of somebody who is roe as hanola. And then finally, you have the last category, or the before the Baal Machlokas category, of Mishiyeshlo Azus Panavenim Spayish Panavish Shigodolimenim. Somebody who is so brazen, they don't have any kind of deference to those who are greater than them. So I would not necessarily have known how to explain this in terms of Machlokas if not for an incident that happened to me. When I took over as the director of the Beis Din of America, this is going back to 1998, a while ago already. So one of the main documents that we were working on at that time was the Halakhic Prenuptial Agreement. And we were trying to promote it, and we were trying to encourage it within the Jewish community in order to prevent aguna issues and aguna problems. So one of the rabbis, who is a very well-respected rabbi within the community, much older than me, much more experienced than me, not necessarily part of the Beis Din milieu in the sense that he wasn't part of our staff, so he wrote a really nasty letter. This must have been maybe the first day of my job. I felt it was a nasty letter because it said really nasty things, or seemed to, about how this is a waste of time, and the prenuptial agreement, the way it exists, is not going to solve anything, and we really need to take bolder steps, and this is insufficient, and I think he even made reference to me that I need to have a better understanding because I don't fully comprehend exactly what this agreement is all about, and I really was very much insulted by the tone and tenor of the letter, and also it was circulated amongst a lot of people. So I wrote back a response in kind. This is my first day on the job. I wrote back a response in kind, in which I explained why this person was basically wrong. I really did feel the person was wrong in terms of the logical arguments that they made, in terms of the halakhic arguments that they made. I was not really deferential in the way in which I referred to it. I didn't insult the person outright. I only sent the letter, I think, to this person and maybe one other person within the Rabbinical Council of America, but somehow the letter got circulated to everybody, and this rabbi was infuriated. He was infuriated that this little whippersnapper that I was taking him on and was speaking about his position, not even him, but his position, and what he felt were non-deferential terms. And there was a whole big brouhaha because this was a person who was important in terms of his stature and standing in the community, even if he wasn't the individual who was going to dictate halakhic policy at the end of the day. And they had to figure out very quickly how to resolve the situation, so they brokered a meeting between myself and this other individual that we should make up, that I should apologize to him. And I basically spent the meeting talking about how wonderful he was, and how much I respected him, and how he is one of the great leaders and architects of the Jewish community, which were all true, by the way, and that I really apologize terribly. I never should have written it in the tone in which I wrote the letter. And he was immediately mollified. And after that point in time, we became very good friends. Adayom hazeh. And I recognized something. I was guilty of this. I did something that led to machlokas by not providing proper deference to somebody who was a more experienced member of the community, even if I disagreed with him. That so often, machlokas can be averted if you just show somebody respect. If you just treat somebody with the requisite kavod, so then it is so easy to be able to avoid machlokas, and then the other person will more readily listen to your position, or at least won't be as offended by your position, even if your position is different from their position. And then finally, we have the last category, which is Mishu Baal Machlokas. So what have we left out that we're bringing into this last category? We spoke about all of these other dimensions where you bring about Machlokas based on your actions or inactions. What about the Baal Machlokas? What are we supposed to learn about this? Obviously, it's like a Kal v'chomer. If all you're doing is stirring up Machlokas, so that would certainly be a Maaser Rishus. That would certainly be wicked. So I think that a large part of what this particular category is standing for is that we're speaking about somebody who is maksik b'machlokis. As it says with respect to Moshe Rabbeinu, Yaakov Moshe v'yelchad the son of Aviram, when Dorsim Aviram took them on, Amar Eshlokish mikan she'in machazikin b'machlokis, to Amarav, call maksik b'machlokis obi b'lav, shenem avloya kikach v'adaso. What was the sin, what was the major failure of Korach and his Eda? The failure was that they were machzik b'machlokis. That was the essence of their rishus. A person can make mistakes, and the mistakes could potentially lead to machlokis. Dosen Mariu made all kinds of mistakes. When we speak about Rosho, Lama Sagariacha, so according to Rashi, that's referring to Dosen Mariu, that had a skirmish with each other. When we speak about Azus Padim, so the Midrash talks about Dosen Mariu as having Azus Padim, as it being brazen, and certainly falling into the third category. But they did not suffer their ultimate fate of being killed and falling into the pit in the ground based on those other mistakes. What caused them ultimately to be punished is that they were machzik b'machlokis. But Moshe Rabbeinu gave them a chance to try to make amends and to try to patch up their differences, so then even though they had a chance at that point in time to rectify their mistakes, they said, absolutely not, we're not going to budge. And they stood their ground. Because they stood their ground, they fell into the ground. Because they were machzik a bit machlokis. And this is especially important. Sometimes we have a feeling, look, the machlokis already exists. What am I supposed to do? Yeah, there were steps that maybe could have been taken to avoid the machlokis. But now the machlokis already exists. And I'm being attacked by the other side, so I may as well engage in the machlokis as well. That's why we have this fourth and ultimate category, a mishu baal machlokis, to teach us, no. You can still rectify it, you can still fix everything, you can still rebuild the base of Mikdash. Even after machlokis has happened, you can still bring about shalom by not being a machzik b'machlokis, by accepting overtures on the other side, and even advancing overtures and creating peace and harmony by yourself. So it's my wish and my bracha that as we are currently engaged in this Bein HaMetzarim period, that we will take apart our ability to transform the mistakes of old and to rectify them and to repair the breach between Taisan and Kodesh Baruch Hu and Bein Adam and Malkum level, and to repair what caused destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, namely the Sinas Chinam, the breaches in Bein Adam L'Chavero, were the source of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash that we're still suffering from, and that we will learn the lessons of our mistakes in the past, and therefore, Bizoka Beroe, Bizim Pasuk, Shayu Shalayim, that we should be Makayim the Pasuk, Be'afakti Ablam, Lisason, B'nichamtim, B'simachtim, V'gonam.
Amen. Good. Okay, we're going to have Marvin in a few minutes.